So this weekend we are headed to the Gospel of Luke chapter 15. We are in the middle of a season on the Christian calendar called Lent, which means Easter is just a few short weeks away. So Lent is a time in which we start to consider some of the more weightier matters of our faith. We began our series called Ash with the idea of repentance. Last weekend, Pastor John did a great job speaking about lament. And this weekend, we're going to turn to the idea of returning. When I was in middle school, I got into a major disagreement with my parents. And I decided I was going to punish them because clearly they were wrong. And I decided the best way to do that would be to run away from home. So I packed a bag and I headed out the door and I went to my friend Jeff's house who lives six doors down. I thought, she'll never find me, and stick it to my parents, ha. About 20 minutes later, Jeff's phone rang. He answered it. He said, it's your mom. And so I said, hello. And she said, come home now, your brothers are scared. And that was the end of my career as a runaway. In the Gospel of Luke, there is another story of a son running away from home. The story is found in the Gospel of Luke chapter 15, and this scenario opens with Jesus being confronted about the company he's keeping. He's hanging around people that are questionable, people that were considered sinners, the lowest of the low, tax collectors, prostitutes, Cubs fans, just the lowest of the low. And so in response to this, Jesus tells a series of stories, a series of parables. He begins with the story of the lost sheep, then he talks about a lost coin, and then he moves to the parable of the lost son. Now, we refer to this story as the prodigal son, though Jesus never calls it that, and it's not the story of one son, it's actually the story of two sons. Luke chapter 15, beginning in verse 11, Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all that he'd had, and he set off for a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and he hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to feed his pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out, go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son and he threw his arms around him and he kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe, put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard his music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on, and the servant said, 'Your brother has come home, and your father's killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you, never disobeying any of your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes, Cub fans. You kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you're always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost, but now he's found. As Jesus tells his story, there are two very distinct narratives or scenarios happening. The first half, we are introduced to the despicable behavior of the son, the broken heart of the father, and the neglect of the older son. Because truly, the behavior of the younger son was quite despicable. He approaches his father and he says, Father, give me my share of the estate, meaning I'd like my inheritance. So basically what he said to his father was, I hate you and I wish you were dead. Now, this wasn't just some kind of teenage angst. I mean, there are teenagers, I was one of them, that when I was younger, you know, in the emotional, hormonal angst would say, Dad, I hate you, Mom, I hate you. But that's not what's going on here. What's going on here is just this visceral hate for his reality. In 1993, when I was 18 years old, I approached my mom, who had begun a bank account for me when I was born, a savings account, and they put money into it. And I went to her, and I said to her when I was 18, I want my money, because I had a plan, and it was a really bad plan, and it was going to lead to some really catastrophic decisions, but I needed to finance my catastrophes. And so I said in kind of a jerky way, Mom, I want my money. And so she gave it to me, and I went and did what I said I was going to do, and it was a disaster, and I lost it all. Now, my ask to my mother wasn't as harsh as, I wish you were dead, but it was certainly distasteful. The son in the story basically says, my best case scenario right now is that you were dead, that you didn't exist. But since that's not possible, at least give me my money. The son hasn't broken any laws per se, but he's certainly broken the heart of his father. Not only was this father going to lose one third of his wealth, which would have been a big deal, having one of your children look you in the eye and say to you, I wish you didn't exist. I don't think there's a price you could put on that. And then, of course, there's the neglect of the older son, because culturally speaking, this son should have at least attempted to step in and talk some sense into his younger brother. But he didn't, and so we continue reading that the younger son runs away. Verse 13, not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had, set off for a distant country, and there he squandered his wealth on wild living. The phrase, he got together everything he had, means he liquidated everything. His inheritance would have most likely come in the form of land and livestock. He sells it, turns it into cash. He's obviously not a good planner. He doesn't invest it. He doesn't start a business. He just goes and he wastes it. Jesus then makes this story incredibly scandalous by then suggesting that this good Jewish boy hired himself out to work with pigs, pigs being an abomination to Jews. Verse 14, after he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to the fields to feed the pigs. And he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Have you ever seen what pigs eat? This guy is lower. His meal plan is lower than that of the pigs. And so we then come to this crucial moment in the story. Verse 17. When he came to his senses. You ever had a moment in which you finally came to your senses? Now, this can mean one of two things, depending on how you interpret the passage, and there are those that can't agree on how it should go, but some say that the phrase, when he came to his senses, means he repented, he had a change of heart, he was going to go back to his father filled with penance and regret. Others say that's not what it means at all. The phrase, he came to his senses, simply means he got smart. He wasn't sorry, he was hungry. And he realized that even his father's servants had three meals a day and a roof over their head. So maybe I'll go back and at least try and get in on him that, on that. But regardless of how you interpret it, the ending is the same. The son returns home. He gets up and goes to his father. And what was supposed to happen, what should have happened, as soon as he entered his village, his community, and all of the villagers learned that his son had lived with Gentiles and wasted his money, a ceremony should have been performed called kizaza. It was a very ancient Jewish ceremony, and it began this way. As soon as the son got in the vicinity of the village elders would have taken a clay pot and thrown it at the feet of the son, shattering it, which was a symbol that now there was a broken relationship between this young man, his community, and his family. The son would then be required to sit outside the gate of his family's home for days before he could see his father. He would eventually be summoned. He would appear before his father. He would be expected to apologize and then expected to move on to a different village to find a job, to find work. In Jesus' day, that would have been justice. But none of that happens. So Jesus takes a scandalous story in which a good Jewish boy works with pigs and makes it even more scandalous by giving us a very different concept of what justice is. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son and threw his arms around him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found," and they began to celebrate. In this story, we're introduced to a biblical ideal of justice, which is noticing something that is wrong and attempting to make it right, often through the means of reconciliation. See, I think sometimes we confuse justice with revenge, which are two very different ideas. So this morning as we sit together, maybe you identify with this younger son. Maybe you've spoken harsh, venomous words, and those words have destroyed a relationship that you're longing to have back. Maybe you have betrayed someone. Maybe you've made some incredibly poor choices, and the cost has been incalculable. Or maybe you've sinned against God, and you're filled with shame and regret. Well, from this story, what we learn is that returning, the journey home may be as easy as saying two words, "I'm sorry." Maybe the greatest spiritual practice that we can engage in this week is, "I'm sorry." That's what the younger son attempted to do. He was going home with those words on his lips. And what he ran into was not the ancient ceremony of kizaza. What he ran into was the reckless love of his father. The old man is depicted as running to his son, something older Middle Eastern men did not do in the days of Jesus. In the Middle East, a man of his age and position always walked with a slow and dignified pace. This father probably hadn't ran in 40 years. He wore a long flowing robe, which was a symbol of his status. He would have had to hike the robe up as to not trip on it in order to run. And so here's this elderly, dignified man with his robe hiked up, running towards his son. He then called for the best robe, a robe that was often reserved for guests of honor. He put a ring on his son's finger, most likely the family signet ring with the family emblem on it, essentially meaning, "Son, you're back on the bank account." He put sandals on his feet. Sandals were reserved for the wealthy. Servants did not wear sandals. And so these three orders given by the father, they're manifest tokens of forgiveness. The son returns. He's forgiven. There's a reconciliation. And in this parable, Jesus is giving us a glimpse into the heart of God. See, the Christian faith is essentially living and experiencing the way of Jesus. A faith that centers on a cross. The cross is the place where injustice and forgiveness collide violently. It's the event in which the victim says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing," while actively having nails driven into his hands and his feet. Now, those that heard this story would have found it incredibly irresponsible and reckless, because they were interested in a very different message, a very different ending to the story. And it had everything to do with what they believed as Jews, what they believed about the Messiah. I want to go back in Jewish history to the 2nd century BC, to a time when a man named Mattathias lived. He was a Jewish priest and was the father of an ancient Jewish hero named Judah Maccabeus. Maccabeus, when translated into English, means the hammer. Judah's nickname was the hammer. He was known as Judah the Hammer, which is awesome. Like, Michael the Hammer, like that, it's got a certain ring to it. At the time of Mattathias and Judah the Hammer, the Jewish nation, they were oppressed by the Greeks. A revolt was sparked in 176 BC when Mattathias killed a Hellenistic Jew who volunteered to sacrifice to a Greek god, which was an abomination. As a result, Mattathias was put to death, and as he was dying, he charged his sons to avenge his death and avenge the wrong done to your people by paying the Gentiles back in full. And so his third son, Judah the Hammer, became the leader of a successful war against the Greeks. Some believed that Judah the Hammer was actually the long-awaited Messiah, the very Son of God. But those dreams were shattered when he made a treaty with the Romans, who ended up being even more oppressive than the Greeks. So 160 years later, when a baby was born in Bethlehem and laid in a manger, when whispers of Messiah began to sweep through the community, Judah the Hammer was the prototype for the avenging Messiah they were expecting, one that would show up, right all of the wrongs, and take up the sword. The reason many rejected Jesus is because he did not fit their predetermined expectation of the avenging Messiah. Jesus wasn't the hammer of God. He came as the Lamb of God. And while they were expecting vengeance, Jesus taught forgiveness. See, what the father of the story knew was there is no future for any of us without forgiveness. See, what we learn from Jesus is the practice of forgiveness is how God has chosen to heal the world. In Jesus' story, the father throws away custom and embraces his son and extends forgiveness before even hearing the well-rehearsed speech that the son had been practicing all the way home. Jesus is teaching, if you want to experience my way always is through the lens of forgiveness. Of course, it's not easy. No one ever promised it would be easy. Jesus certainly didn't. In the Gospel of Matthew chapter 16, Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, like if you want to follow after me, you need to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Taking up your cross is really hard work. Crosses are heavy. But when Jesus uttered the words, take up your cross and follow me, take up your cross is another way of saying, follow my way. And if you want to follow my way, one of the crosses that we're all going to carry is the cross in which we're willing to extend forgiveness. Nope, it's not easy. Sometimes it even seems impossible, impossibly hard, but yet the call of the one that we worship is a call of invitation to do the very thing that he did, to deny ourselves take up our own cross and follow him. Now maybe here this morning you identify more with the Father because you have been wronged in some way. You've been mistreated. And the greatest spiritual practice for you this week is to extend forgiveness. Now you may say, Mike, that's fine, that's nice to say in church, but do you realize what they did? Mike, do you realize the bully or the boss that made my life hell day after day after day? Mike, do you understand the way in which my husband or my wife betrayed me? Mike, that person stabbed me in the back when I was down. Mike, this is good and fine, but do you understand the abuser who violated my dignity? Or my parents who really weren't parents? Mike, do you know what it was like to grow up in my home? When that person committed that crime against me, they took away all my security. And in many cases, I don't. And at the same time, the practice of Christianity will often put us in the place when we utter the words, I forgive you. Now, it doesn't mean you forget. We often utter the phrase, forgive and forget. That is so dumb. Nobody forgets. It's not like we forgive and all of a sudden get amnesia. Forgiveness doesn't mean that you become best buddies and start going to Brewers games together. It doesn't necessarily mean that the relationship or even the marriage is salvageable. It doesn't mean the friendship is restored to what it once was. And it often does mean that even though you've forgiven, the consequences of the offense are not completely erased. Because sometimes poor decisions have financial consequences. Sometimes they have relational consequences. And sometimes even though you forgive, they still need to go to jail. But what it does mean is that we start to reflect in small glimmers the heart of the Father who was lavish in his forgiveness and reckless in his love. Because the other choice is to live with the animosity of the older brother. Verse 25, meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, and so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother's come home, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he said, look, all these years I've been slaving for you, never disobeying you one time, and yet you never gave me a young goat to celebrate with my friends. But when this despicable son of yours, who squandered everything, comes home, you kill the fattened calf. Like, he doesn't want forgiveness, he wants revenge. He wants the son to get what he deserves, because this younger son is despicable. He wanted him to hurt. He wanted him to feel pain. And so in the older brother's smugness and self-righteousness begins to get lost in resentment, which is always a pathway to bitterness. When I withhold unforgiveness, when I choose to live in resentment, it's like I drink the poison expecting it to hurt somebody else. In many ways, that is the exhausting historical narrative of Christianity. I'm reading a book right now called The Evangelicals. It's written by a historian. It's a huge tome of a book. I'm on page 200. And for the first 200 pages, it's essentially been this group fighting with this Christian group, fighting with this Christian group kicking this guy out of their Christian group, this Christian group splitting and forming this denomination, then they fight and they form this denomination, and they all get mad at each other, and then there's all this division and angst. And so right now I'm on the chapter in which we get to Billy Graham. And Billy Graham, I discovered, was kicked out of his fundamentalist group because he was too graceful. So much hostility right now. I mean, don't we see it? Can't we see it? We all see it. And sometimes we're a part of it. Because I'll tell you what 2020 was for us, that year 2020, that train wreck of a year, like it was the great divider and the great revealer of the human heart. I believe that the arguing, the offense, and the refusal to say I'm sorry and I forgive you is destroying us, because God's plan to heal the world has always been through forgiveness. I got to believe I can do better. In ancient Asian cultures, as a greeting, ancient Asians would some cultures bow and look each other in the eye. And as they bow, what they were essentially was saying is, I honor the light in you. That's what the message is. What would change if we could look at each other and honor the image of God contained in every single one of us? I mean, for some of us, we're the older son. We are so lost in anger and bitter and resentment and unforgiveness, and we're holding on to it, and it's killing our soul. It's destroying us. When we choose to walk in forgiveness, what we experience is the celebration of God. At the end of the story, the son says to his older son, you're always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate. This brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. We had to celebrate. When we live in forgiveness, I think I can hear the celebration in heaven. See, this is a story of returning and forgiveness and reconciliation, and I hear God rejoice. Maybe in the end, it's not a returning to another person. Maybe for some of us, it's simply a returning to God himself. And like the prodigal son, we bring all of our baggage with us, and instead of receiving judgment, what we get is the arms of a father wrapping us in a robe, putting a ring on our finger, and putting sandals on our feet. But it's hard. Forgiveness is never easy. Giving it or receiving it. And so today as we end, the worship team is going to come back, and they're going to close with a song called Reckless Love. And I've asked them to play this song because the song, the theology of the song, much of it comes from Luke chapter 15, which we just read. There's a phrase in that song that talks about Jesus leaving the 99. That's a reference to Luke 15, in which Jesus says, I'll leave the 99 sheep to go after the one that's strayed. So they're going to sing that in a moment, and I hope you'll make it a part of your worship. But I want to end by praying a prayer that's more of a poem than it is a prayer, but I want you to enter it with me as a prayer. It'll be on the screens. It's also on your note sheet. It's from a book, and the prayer is called The Prayer Before the Prayer. I want to be willing to forgive, but I dare not ask for the will to forgive, in case you give it to me and I'm not yet ready. I'm not yet ready for my heart to soften, not yet ready to be vulnerable again, not yet ready to see that there is humanity in my tormentor's eyes, or that the one who hurt me may also have cried. I'm not yet ready for the journey. I'm not yet interested in the path. I'm at the prayer before the prayer of forgiveness. Grant me the will to want to forgive. Grant it to me, not yet, but soon. Can I even form the words, forgive me? Dare I even look? Do I dare see the hurt I have caused? I can glimpse all of the shattered pieces of that fragile thing, that soul trying to rise on the broken wings of hope, but only out of the corner of my eye. I'm afraid of it. And if I'm afraid to see, how can I not be afraid to say, forgive me? Is there a place where we can meet, you and me? The place in the middle, the no man's land, where we straddle the lines, where you are right and I'm right too, and both of us are wrong and wronged, can we meet there and look for the place where the path begins? There's a path that ends when we forgive.